This is the Drive and Dish Podcast, talking about NBA news, stats, and fantasy. To start it off, it's Tim Tompkins.
The San Antonio Spurs are the real-life equivalent of a sexy librarian.
Kevin Rayfuse.
The Cavaliers are like the kid that keeps dropping their ice cream, so you stop feeling bad after the first time.
And Justin Cousart.
A little life lesson here. If you're having questions in life, just think, would Swaggy P do it?
Let's go.
So it's been a busy week or so for the both of us. Really for Tim, though. Tim's been on... I think this is like the fifth podcast that Tim has recorded now in the past 4 days. So he's a little podcasted out, to say the least. And Tim's going to tell you all about those episodes in a little bit. But I want to tell you guys first, because Tim Tompkins is still, for those of you who are new to the podcast, and I'm just going to say it, Tim Tompkins is a hipster. He won't admit he's a hipster, but Tim Tompkins is a hipster. We're not going to talk about why. But so we're recording this via Skype right now. And so I get on Skype and Tim says, dude, I did the most hipster thing ever today. And I said, Tim, how did you spend your day? And Tim spent his day going to a record sale at a dive bar while he was drinking a PBR and vaping.
Let me just say that while I was also at that dive bar, I was watching a NBA game. So I feel like it maybe wasn't the most hipster thing of all time, because I'm not sure that hipsters watch sports.
I don't. Well, you watch sports. Well, you watch one sport, which I feel like is extra hipster. Like, it's weird with you. And I have a roommate who used to be like this in college, only with baseball. But you with basketball. For as much as Tim Tompkins knows about basketball and studies this game and watches film and goes over plays and does all that stuff, he doesn't watch a single other sport.
No, that's not true. Sometimes I watch golf.
Right. Sometimes I watch golf. The Masters were awesome. I don't know if you watched the Masters, but the Masters were awesome this year.
No.
Sergio, finally getting it done.
I'm unfortunate. Unfortunately, I don't have cable right now, so I haven't watched as much golf as I would like. But golf is actually a really relaxing sport. I think I would really like to be a golf commentator.
Oh, yeah, dude. Well, plus you're always going to beautiful areas, like, because you can only golf when there's nice weather. So even in the winter, you're going to, like, Hawaii and South America and all these other places where, you know, it's the middle of summertime. And the beauty of golf is, it's funny, because I don't think I appreciated golf growing up. And I'm like, I don't get it. Why do people watch this? Dude, last Sunday for the final round of the Masters, I started watching it. It was great. I was a little tired. We had, you know, gone out the night before, took a little 2-hour quick siesta. Woke back up. There was still golf on. It was wonderful.
So, Kevin, I guess I should say, and not just to you, it was really weird. So, to your point earlier, I've done a lot of podcasting this weekend. The Sun Solar Panel, where we had Eric Bledsoe on, we put out 2 episodes of The Drive and Dish. I went on Joe Borelli's podcast, The Superflight, and I did a radio interview on Friday talking NBA playoffs. The second episode that we put up this weekend, which did feature Joe Borelli, it felt really weird to put up that second one without either you or Justin. I was really worried that the listener would think that you guys were just done from the Drive and Dish.
Because you had put the two out back to back without us?
Yeah. It was a real, like, so I had to record a whole new intro and be like, look, if you guys are worried, no Kevin and no Justin, they are not gone. We just happened to have recorded 2 episodes without them, but they're very, very much still here. They just weren't here on Friday and Saturday.
It's just funny because I think for the past 2.5 months, we put out a good quality amount of episodes, probably like 2 a week, basically, for the last 2 or 3 months. And I think you, Justin, and I have successfully recorded like 2 podcasts in that entire time.
Yeah, well, it's hard now for anybody wondering. I mean, you and me and Justin are just on completely different schedules.
Well, now that we're a bit more settled, it's easier on the weekend. Preface for those of you who are listening to this and haven't figured it out, Justin is not here today. So I guess we should welcome everybody in to the Drive and Dish NBA podcast. My name is Kevin Rayfuse. Joining me to my left, my co-host, Tim Tompkins.
Although Justin is not here, in his honor, I am going to read a tweet. All my condolences to Isaiah Thomas makes me realize that there's way more important things in life than a knee.
Yeah. Oh, that was Gobert. I saw that. Gobert tweeted that, which, Rudy Gobert's knee. That's so terrible. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But yeah, this Isaiah Thomas thing, man, it's tough. His sister was 22 years old. She was killed in a car accident on I-5 up in Washington State. It's just really sad. I think it's, it is one of those unfortunate reminders that there are bigger things in life than basketball. And, you know, our prayers and thoughts are with the Thomas family. And, you know, we hope they can get through this incredibly sad time, difficult time.
Yeah, China Thomas. So I was reading the report on it, and apparently it was at 5 o'clock in the morning. She just drifted off the road, ran into a barrier and then into a pole. After that, she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. I just can't imagine what Isaiah Thomas and his family, but, you know, we're a basketball podcast. We'll stick this Isaiah Thomas. Isaiah Thomas is going through entering these playoffs and this postseason, having lost his sister. I mean, I've lost members of my family before, and as hard as those losses were, I cannot imagine losing my sister.
It's tough. I mean, any immediate family obviously is going to hit harder than others. You know, it's just sad. There's not really much else to do. And you know, it's such an emotional time already, getting fired up for these playoff games and having to go out and compete and have, you know, be not only physically performing at your best level, but mentally performing at your best level. And, you know, Isaiah is going to play, and you hope that this provides almost a bit of a relief from the real world. Our thoughts and prayers with the Thomas family. But yes, happy things. Tim, talk to the people. What are we working on?
So what we are working on right now, which is really, really, really exciting for us, and that is getting the Drive and Dish podcast out to NBA Summer League in Las Vegas. And, over the last couple of summers, you, me, and Justin, we've gone down to Orlando and we've done that, but the Las Vegas Summer League is much more encompassing. And it would just mean a lot for the Drive and Dish podcast. Unfortunately, it's really expensive to get three people to take 5-6 days off of work to fly out from Florida to Vegas to rent a hotel room for 5 days, to buy the tickets for 5 days, and we're on a radio salary, so we can't afford it. So we're doing a group funding, or a crowdfunding thing, I guess you should say. And if you want to contribute, there's a really easy way to do so. If you've enjoyed the Drive and Dish podcast over the last 3.5 years, and you want to contribute, it would mean the world to us. We're going to keep talking about it until we hit our goal. But it really does mean the world. And all you have to do is go to driveanddishpodcast.com. The link is at the top. It's also at the top of our Facebook page. Honestly, even a dollar helps. $5 is a huge help. Anything more, we'll be eternally grateful. We're going to be podcasting the whole time we're there. We're going to, you know, meet some of the NBA writers that we've always wanted to meet, and it'll just mean the world. So we should give a shout out to those who have already donated to the cause. That is Nicole Kaiser, Liz Kaiser, Tommy May, shout out to Tommy, and Samantha Graham. Thank you all so very much for helping the Drive and Dish podcast go out to NBA Summer League.
Dropping fire content for you, hopefully. And we'll be doing the Orlando one too, which is nice. You know, now instead of driving 2 hours down to Orlando, I'm just like walking a few minutes over.
So go to driveanddishpodcast.com and we'll give you a shout out on the show. And honestly, it'll mean the world to us.
Tell me something I do not know. Do not know.
Now. If you do not know the present, how can you claim to know the future?
Now on NBA News on the Drive and Dish podcast.
We need to know now.
The news this week, keeping it short and sweet for you, because if you want your NBA playoff update, you can always go over to NBA.com for that. But we'll start this off with the final reverse standings of the season. The Nets, a.k.a. the Celtics, with the most likely spot at that number one pick. The Suns with the second, the Lakers with the third. The Magic and Sixers round out the bottom five. Chris Bosh has expressed mixed feelings on returning to the NBA, but did say that it is possible. And Phil Jackson of the Knicks, this last weekend in the exit interviews, referring to Carmelo Anthony, said, quote, he would be better off somewhere else. The NBA Players Association fired back, saying, quote, if players under contract cannot, under threat of league discipline, speak openly about their desire to be employed elsewhere, we expect management to adhere to the same standards. You gotta admit, they have a point. And that's your news for this week.
Something.
Look, basketball is so much better in person. You know this, I know this, and that's why I want to tell you about SeatGeek, because just last week, Kevin, Justin, and myself, we all used it when we went down to see the Indiana Pacers play the Orlando Magic, and we needed to get 6 tickets together, and we needed it at a good deal, which getting 6 tickets together actually isn't all that easy. But you know who made it easy? And that is SeatGeek. And that is because SeatGeek is the smartest way to find tickets for the basketball games you want to see live and up close during the playoffs. There's nothing like being in the building for the biggest games, and with SeatGeek, it's never been easier to get guaranteed seats you want for a great value, and that's because they work like a ticket aggregating service. Plus, there's 100%
guarantee on all their tickets so you can shop with confidence. And the best part is, Drive and Dish listeners, you get $20 off your first purchase. All you got to do to get your $20 rebate on tickets is download the SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, click add a promo, enter the promo code DISH, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first purchase. Download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code DISH today.
Well, a little bit, Mike. There's no excuse. I don't know if we played hard enough to deserve to win. I thought they outplayed us. They played harder longer than we did. No matter what you do offensively or your rhythm is off or whatever, you still can run back on defense, make them feel you defensively, which I didn't think we did. And, I just don't know. I got to look at the film and see. But I thought they played with more force for longer than we did. That's the thing, Doug. But it starts on the ball. We got to make sure we contain the ball. We've got to do a good job of informing who you're guarding, how you're guarding, which way they're going to go. But again, that starts the chain reaction. And it starts on the ball, containing the basketball. Brogdon got to where he wanted to go against us, broke us down, found people. But again, like you said, this next effort is getting out to the shooter and making them feel us. And they did it to us. And we got to be prepared and ready to make that next effort.
Pacers coach Nate McMillan there. We tweeted from our account in the first half that the Cavs were pick and rolling the Pacers to death. So, I think you have to be enthused if you're the Pacers, what you saw from the second half of game one and really going forward in the series. Indy, a strong second half finisher. I got to be honest, and we won't get to make this prediction, but I do just want to fire this take off. If Indy was the 8 seed, I would have had them beating Boston the first round. I'm just going to put that out there. I think they're really going to push Cleveland this series. What are your initial thoughts? There was certainly a lot of controversy around that last shot in game one. Just a really smart defensive play, I thought, from drawn up by Ty Lue and then LeBron to, really blitz on that double team, have J.R. Smith guard him and have LeBron blitz it, force, the split second decision and get the Pacers, force the Pacers to settle for a shot somewhere else. What were your initial impressions of the series so far? Where do you think we're at going forward?
The series, or specifically the final play of the end of regulation and
well,
game
let's
one?
Talk about the final play first. I guess since that just happened, for those of you who didn't see the end of game one, Paul George had the ball at the top of the key. J.R. Smith was guarding him. LeBron James basically blitzed him, forced him to pass it up. It went into the hands of C.J. Miles. C.J. Miles got off a clean look I thought it was a good clean look, especially with the play being broken. Paul George did get back open, but again, it's one of those split second things. You got to react when the clock's going low. I thought it was more savvy by the Cavs than it was lack of execution for the Pacers. I honestly thought the Pacers got a good look. You want Paul George taking that shot, and you hear LeBron in the post game interview saying our goal was to prevent anyone other than Paul George to get that shot. I think if you're the Cavs, you have to be okay with that. But I think if you're the Pacers, yeah, it's not Paul George, but it's not like it was the worst look ever either, and that they just dribbled out the clock. CJ Miles had a clean open look.
So Nate McMillan, he talked about it a little bit in the interview that when they double, you have to do a better job of making yourself available and making shots when they come. And then in Paul George's comments post game, he said that he had told CJ Miles that he needs to get the ball back to him, and that really bothered me. I'm getting tired of Paul George in his comments about his teammates, and his where it makes it seem like he wants to be out of Indiana, where you don't trust your teammates. C.J. Miles got a wide open look. The ball didn't go in. I think that was probably the best for the Pacers. But at a certain point, the superstar players have to trust their teammates. And Paul George, in the post-game interview saying that he told C.J. Miles he needs to get the ball back to him.
I don't know if I'm bothered by it because I like the responsibility that Paul George is placing upon himself. There's a pep talk that got referenced during the broadcast that Nate McMillan had basically had a conversation with Paul George where he said, look, Paul, look at what Russell Westbrook has had to deal with all season with Kevin Durant leaving and basically putting on these guys on his back and challenging Paul George and saying, if you're this good, put the team on your back, go out and do everything every night and battle. And if you're Paul George, I think the play before he hit the three pointer from the parking lot. It looked like it was two or three steps into his 30 foot or something like that to even get them in that situation. Paul George had been great all game. He is the clear best player on that team. It's tough because I don't think he probably should have said that in the public. But at the same time, you know, this is your best player. This is your guy. You want him taking charge. You want him engaged. Our complaint with Paul George really a lot of this season has been, it seems like he's been just kind of loafing around. I like that there's a little bit of a spark in this Pacers team. I like that Paul George is fired up and playing well again. I mean, he closed the second half of the season strong and really has put people on a reminder tour just of how good he is. I don't think it necessarily was handled the right way, so I agree with you to that point. I think CJ Miles had a good look. I think it's a split-second decision. Things happen. I know Paul George wanted the ball back. I know he did get open there in a second, but again, you know, when there's 3 seconds left and you have to get a shot off, people make decisions. I think it was the worst decision in the world. Could it have been handled a little bit differently? Yeah, but I also like Paul George stepping up and being like, yo, I'm the guy here. This is my team. We're going to live and die through me. Let's get it. I like seeing that out of Paul George. I feel like we haven't seen that this year.
And there is an innate amount of value to that. I mean, you know, we want, for as good as Paul George is, for him to be the man on that team. But is that a comment that, you know, LeBron James would have made at the end of it?
Sure it is. LeBron's made plenty of these comments.
LeBron James passes the ball to Kyrie Irving for a shot at the end of the game because he trusts his teammates.
Oh, and I agree with that too.
That's part of leadership. Isn't just sure, saying, but I'm going to put it on my back. It's saying I trust the people around me too. Oh,
I agree with that 100%. But to say LeBron hasn't done this, LeBron in that Bulls series a few years ago straight up said, I changed David Blatt's play call. This is what we're doing. This is what I'm doing. I'm not trusting my teammates when they had him inbounding the ball. So, I mean, you know, I think everybody does this. It's not the best way to handle it, but I also like him taking the responsibility. That enthuses me if I'm a Pacers fan. I also think the Pacers have a better chance to keep Paul George than they did around the trade deadline. I'm just going to put that out there.
If you want to take the responsibility of making sure that the ball stays in your hand, then run a high screen and roll instead of dribbling the ball out for 4 seconds near the half court line. Right? Like run a play in which you can't get doubled.
And that's valid too. Like it's one of those things. I thought it was an aggressive play by the Cavs. And I think it did throw them off. It's one of those things where it becomes down the stretch. We saw, for example, the Joe Johnson play, which we're going to talk about. Chris Paul makes the layup. Utah doesn't call a timeout. LA can't get set up necessarily. The game breaks down and you just force guys to make plays. Indy had called timeout, you know, looking for that last shot, a chance to win the game. You can draw up a play, but you also allow them to set up the defense. And I think Indy did have to do a better job of knowing what to do when Paul George gets doubled, assuming that's going to happen. The Cavs made a good play. They gambled and it worked. You know, I don't think it's, again, if you're Indy, I don't think you necessarily hate that look if I'm a Pacers fan. CJ Miles was wide open. He just didn't make the shot. If he makes that shot, we're not talking about any of this right now.
I mean, so, I agree. I thought it was a great look. You know, yeah, I mean, you have to hit wide open shots is the only thing in the playoffs. Like, you have to hit wide open shots, but I do question the leadership from Paul George. Like, those comments just kind of rub me the wrong way.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I could see it, but, you know, we'll see what. Again, I like the way they finished, and I like the way they played with the energy and going out strong. And the Pacers, I've enjoyed watching for the past 2 or 3 weeks. It's a shame that it really took them so long to kind of find their identity. I think they could have been seeded a lot higher, and they could have been going potentially a lot deeper than they would otherwise. You know, unfortunately, now you got Cleveland first round. I don't think they're beating Cleveland.
So that is the Lance Stephenson effect then, right? I mean, since
that... Hey, it's real, man. I can't even knock it or make fun of it. Look at how much they... Look at what he's done attitude-wise. What has been our argument with the Pacers all year? As they haven't played with any emotion or identity. I'll tell you what, Lance, if nothing else, gets them fired up.
He also was a positive 5.3 on the court in those last 6 games with Indiana, and the only game in which he was a negative on the court. I think he was a -6, and that was with his first game with Indiana. I was a bit surprised that the Cavs were putting Kevin Love on Lance Stephenson on those defensive plays, though, weren't you?
Well, they were just basically daring Lance to shoot. I think they allowed Kevin Love to be a floater. I mean, even on that last possession, they were giving Lance all. It was like the Robertson effect, essentially, that we saw in Oklahoma City. They were sagging so far off him that it's like, look, if Lance Stephenson is going to beat us with jump shots, we'll take that risk every single time. And so it allowed Cleveland to get, you know, a little more flexible in their schemes and, you know, allow for more doubles and allow kind of a floater, essentially. They're willing to let Stevenson beat them with jumpers, which, you know, I'll take that strategy too if I'm Cleveland.
After watching just game one, are you any more confident that the Pacers are going to make this much longer series than people anticipate from a 2-8, or excuse me, from a 2-7 matchup?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I thought all along, honestly, the way Indy was playing and the way Cleveland was playing kind of towards the end. You know, Cleveland is one of those teams that there were people I was seeing takes out there that if this got taken to 6 or 7, that Cleveland should immediately push the panic button. I don't think that at all. I think Indy is a much tougher 7 seed than they're getting a lot of credit for. I think best case scenario for Indy is they take 1 or 2 in this series. I think they get at least 1. I can't see them getting swept. I just think they play too tough. But these are all going to be, you know, these are going to be competitive games. This is a good wake-up call for Cleveland, I think. It's going to get them, you know, Cleveland is not going to sleepwalk through 3 rounds. They're going to have, I mean, every single series is going to be tough. Indy's a good, tough first-round matchup. Those last 2 or 3 weeks, that was a different Indiana Pacers team. That was the Pacers team that I thought we were going to see all year. Because if I go back to our preseason predictions, you, me, and Justin all were high on the Pacers. It just took a little bit longer than usual. It's a shame, too, because I think they could, you know, if they were playing Boston or Toronto or Washington, that is not an easy out. I could smell upset there. I said it earlier. If they had played Boston, I would have been picking the 8-1 upset.
Are you not picking the 1-8 upset now, though? TNT Bulls, man. Come on. It's real.
I know, and it's going to be closer than I think it's going to go 6 or 7. Like, genuinely not even getting hot takey with the TNT Bulls. I really think the Bulls have been playing a lot better, too, in the second half. And I think they kind of figured something out with that lineup with Mirotić at 4. They'll have Wade off the bench. I think the Celtics are preparing for playoff Rondo. That could maybe be a thing. I still think Boston is getting by. But, I mean, here's my thing with Boston. Boston's got to do it for me in the playoffs, man. I got to see that score-by-committee approach. I got to see it work in the playoffs. There's going to be a lot of burden on Isaiah Thomas. And that was way before any of this, just in general. He means so much to that offense. If Isaiah Thomas isn't hitting his shots, I worry about who's going to step up and hit him on Boston.
You worry about Isaiah Thomas hitting his shots?
I do it in the playoffs. I want to see it. Yeah, I do. I think it started to fade in the second half of the year. I think he's going to get his, don't get me wrong, and I think the Celtics are going to get by this first-round series, but I am lower on the Celtics than I am a lot of these other, you know, teams. I've said on this podcast multiple times, I thought Cleveland and Toronto were both significantly better than Boston. I think Milwaukee would give Boston fits. I think Indy would give Boston fits. I think Washington would be a tough second-round matchup with Boston. Boston's got to prove it to me. Toronto's got to prove it to me, too, honestly, right now. If I'm looking at I went bet big on Toronto, which I guess we should start talking about. You're listening to the Drive and Dish NBA podcast. Kevin Rafuse, Tim Tompkins, Justin Kuzart. Follow us on Twitter at Drive and Dish NBA. You know, a few weeks ago on this podcast, I said I thought Toronto had turned the corner. They had really solidified themselves as the second-best team in the East. Here we are. Toronto's lost the first game again. Milwaukee was just beating them with length, essentially. They're running all over them. Toronto, God, can't let Giannis get out in transition. P.J. Tucker made some interesting comments after the game about how the locker room's like, oh, whatever, we always lose game one. You know, he's not happy about it. Kyle Lowry didn't shoot well. I will say I was enthused by DeMar DeRozan's performance, but, you know, where are we at with Toronto? Should Toronto be worried?
Well, I want to keep it real quick to the Boston Celtics comments you made. I mean, if I'm playing the Boston Celtics in the playoffs, I'm going to trap Isaiah Thomas the whole time. I'm going to get the ball out of his hands. Yeah. So, you know, saying that Isaiah Thomas has got to make shots, I don't agree with that. I mean, he does have to make shots. That's a valid point. You know, we're in the playoffs. But I think if you're Isaiah Thomas, that you have to find yourself effective playing off ball. You know, and how do the Celtics make that happen? How much of that offense do they need to run through Al Horford and Marcus Smart? You know, can Avery Bradley continue the level of play that he's kept? Because the Celtics have been so much better with Avery playing as well as he has. So I don't quite think it's as simple, though, as making sure that Isaiah Thomas hits his shots as much as the entire team has to step up around him and Isaiah Thomas has to play off ball, no?
Well, that's what I mean, and I'm a little worried about that fact, is we've seen Isaiah Thomas be able to step up and carry this team to wins, but now that we're in the playoffs, other teams are going to force Isaiah Thomas the ball out of his hands and him to play off ball. They're going to make – it's going to be like the Paul George effect with Indy. They're going to make everybody else except Isaiah Thomas beat you, and – you know, so much of Boston's success this year has been Isaiah Thomas scoring a lot of points. And if he isn't scoring a lot of points and they are forcing the ball out of his hands, that's what my fear is with Boston, is I worry about, you know, you need guys like Marcus Smart and Avery Bradley and Jay Crowder and Al Horford to step up. And I have faith in Brad Stevens to coach them up. Like, I have no worries about Boston's coaching and preparedness and any of that. Like, they're going to be a strong defensive team. Like, I don't want to make it sound like I'm super, super low on Boston, but I do have worries about that. Who's going to be that second guy and who's going to step up for Boston?
Your point with the Bucks. So I was looking over where Giannis was getting shots, and you know, to your point, PJ Tucker's comments, I think a lot of what PJ Tucker was talking about though was getting back in transition, and you have to be really aware.
Oh, yeah. Well, especially in Milwaukee.
Of where Giannis is. But the vast majority of Giannis' shots were well contested. I'm still really, really high on Toronto. I'm still picking Toronto to win the series, regardless of where it's at right now.
Oh, yeah, of course. Don't get me wrong.
But, I mean, playoff Giannis, like that dude at 22 years old, to me, he's better now than LeBron James was at 22. I think he's better than Kevin Durant was at 22. And Giannis at this point, right now, and getting hot takey as
Ooh, I'm as, ready. As fired up, baby. I'm ready.
I mean, he's 22 years old. He is absolutely unbelievable. There's that one meme going around the internet right now where Giannis was touching the rim and the floor at the same time.
Like, yeah, it's the last 3 years with Giannis it's always been, I think, especially last year, you started to get people to say, is he ever going to hit the ceiling? Everybody keeps talking about how good he could be. And now I think that people have a taste of how good Giannis is. I mean, I got to be honest, Milwaukee to me could be the next team to win the Eastern Conference that's not Cleveland. Like, if they can get Jabari Parker healthy with any, like, those knees are a concern. Unfortunately, they just have to be now with multiple ACL injuries. But it's a shame because so much of the year they were missing Middleton. But if you get Giannis, who continues to develop and is already this good, you've got Jabari Parker, who's been a borderline all-star already. You've got Chris Middleton, who I think is an excellent 3-and-D guy. You've got Thon Maker. Thon Maker is so interesting to me because at one point he was widely regarded as the guy in high school. And then it just kind of dropped off, him going pro scenario and a little bit of murkiness about all that. And so his stock really slipped. It was just weird how he went from, oh yeah, this kid's definitely going to go number one eventually, to where he kind of, like, everyone thought Milwaukee reached on him, and all of a sudden his ceiling again is what it used to be. And it's just kind of weird how it dropped off like that. And now people are talking about, you know, I heard in the broadcast yesterday, people were talking about Thon Maker, how there were people who genuinely believed he could be the best center in the league in a few years.
And that's wild to me. I mean, Thon Maker is really good. I was a little bit surprised though by Jason's kids. Rotations, you know, no John Henson, Greg Monroe. He played a lot. He played 25 minutes, but playing Thon Maker over him. I'm wondering, you know, Jason Kidd, the last time that he coached against the Toronto Raptors in the playoffs, you know, the Brooklyn Nets won that in a 7-game series on that Paul Pierce block against Kyle Lowry.
Mm-hmm.
And what, you know, what kind of
that's why they brought him here,
right? Speaking of, to Joe Johnson, I bet that's what he was yelling. But What kind of irrational confidence does that give to Jason Kidd in this series right here?
Oh, you've got to love it if you're Jason Kidd, because if you're the Bucks right now, you go into Toronto, which was absolutely ravenous yesterday. The combo of the Raptors and the Toronto Maple Leafs, which I know you're not a big NHL guy, but the Toronto Maple Leafs are the biggest franchise in the entire league, and they've been really bad for a long time. Like, they haven't won a Stanley Cup since 1967. So that combo absolutely has the city on fire. So going in there, stealing that game one and doing it convincingly, having Giannis look as good as he does, you know, with Toronto, these questions are going to come back, and they're always going to come back until Toronto really puts them away. And you're going to hear the, is Kyle Lowry struggling in the playoffs again questions, and the, can Toronto win a first game, and does Valanciunas do enough? You know, all these things are coming back up. Again, I'm not worried. I don't want to sound like I'm pushing the panic button on Toronto. Toronto, I have going to the Eastern Conference, well, in the bracket. I'd be picking Toronto to go to the Eastern Conference Finals if they wouldn't have to play Cleveland in the second round. So I don't want to sound like I'm hitting the panic button. But Milwaukee came out with an excellent game plan. You've got to adjust if you're Toronto. Milwaukee beat them with length and getting out into transition. If Milwaukee gets out into transition with Giannis, it's over. Like, you're finished. The dude is too athletic. Nobody can keep up with him. Toronto's got to do a better job, and to your point, you mentioned that with PJ Tucker earlier, they've got to prevent those transition points.
His offensive rating in game one was a 130. His defensive rating was an 89. I mean, this was a defensive win, in my mind, mm-hmm. From the Bucks, and, you know, lack thereof from the Raptors. But I mean, it was also close for the majority of the game. It was really the fourth where it came down. But Chris Middleton, so he had the best plus minus of any Bucks player on the floor in that game. He was a plus 27 in 40 minutes, which is really funny to me. So he played 40 minutes. His true shooting percentage was 31%. He was 4 of 15. He had 10 points, but yet he had the best plus minus of any player on the court in that entire game. And it's stats like that that really make me scratch my head a little bit when you're trying to wrap your head around stats and like what means what. But you can have a player that's so impactful, which is something that I talked about with Brian on the Bucks and Six episode on Friday, that whether or not that guy's making shots, he's just so impactful on the court.
Yeah, defense matters. I mean, that's the reality of it. In playing within the flow of an offense, you don't have to score to be valuable. Which sounds like such an obvious statement, but I feel like that gets lost in the sauce sometimes. People only look at, you know, shooting lines and shooting percentages. There's so much more than that.
I was really happy to see so much Ibaka at five.
Justin started. Was it you that fired off the Greg, is Greg Monroe better than Ibaka tweet? Was that Justin?
That was Justin. That was not me.
Okay, because you went stop it. And I'm like, wait, did Tim fire off that take and then shame his own take? Because I was sitting there, why did that tweet tech open? But I was like, I didn't tweet that. And so, like, that's the game we have sometimes. We're all watching it on Twitter at the same time. I agree. I think those small ball line. I mean, that's why you got Ibaka, is that you can play some of those smaller lineups, you know, especially when Cleveland, for example, goes small and really a lot, you know, with Tristan Thompson playing the five. They don't have that traditional center. So, you know, you get a guy like Ibaka who, in theory, would keep him off the boards. I know we've already moved on from Cleveland to Indiana, but it felt like there was one point of that game where Tristan Thompson got every single offensive rebound ever.
Dude, can we just talk about how Tristan Thompson just, like, finds a way to make himself valuable for 16 games out of the year and nothing else?
I told you, when that contract first got signed, I remember we trash-talked it so much. And the thing is now is I ain't even mad. It's the playoffs. You're paying him for 16 games. Those are an important 16 games.
Just like, it blows my mind. I'm like, here is Tristan Thompson doing things once out of the year. Like, it blows my mind. I'm like, why can't Tristan Thompson just do this? If this is how he's going to play, just bench him until the playoffs and then bring him up again.
I love that LeBron James and Kyrie Irving released their playoff sneakers this year. And they've essentially braced the fact that they weren't doing well at the end of the season, and they called them the flip the switch pack.
are you? I know you're much more of a sneakerhead than I am. Are you getting those?
No. I'm moving, man. I'm way too bogged down in moving costs before I'm even looking at any new sneakers right now. I'm a bit retired. I'm a recovering sneakerhead, if you will say.
Yeah. No, I understand. I'm a recovering glasses head, so I feel you on that.
Well, you're a recovering glasses head. Are you done buying glasses?
I think for the moment, right now, I'm working on my magnet game.
Your magnet game?
Yeah, I want better magnets on my fridge, so I'm buying a whole bunch of magnets right now.
How many? I feel like that can be done in like a day and a half.
No, because it's really hard to find good magnets. You can just go out and get magnets, but I want my magnets to be special. You know, I want them to be unique. I want them to be funny. I just don't want magnets from anywhere. I mean, come on.
No,
I'm not
going
to go to
the
grocery store and pick up magnets.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to say go to Target and get the alphabet.
Not doing that. Can we talk about the Spurs-Grizzlies game a bit? Because the Spurs' offensive rating in that game was 130. The the Grizzlies' offensive rating in that game was a 96. And I thought going into this series, and obviously the series isn't over, the Memphis can turn it around and yada, yada, yada. But I thought going into this series, what they're going to do is that they are going to take Zebo and they're just going to have him feast on LaMarcus Aldridge. And Zebo, in 26 minutes of play, he was a negative 39 while on the court.
That's not good, Bob. Not good. Yeah, they really, it's funny. I think everybody expects Memphis to just slow it down and that they could get San Antonio to play that way because it's, you know, San Antonio isn't your Golden State Houston offense that's super high firepower. And I think people thought it was going to be that, and it just really wasn't. And I think people are also underestimating San Antonio's offense a little bit. I think that Memphis is really missing Tony Allen. You know, you talk about guys like Danny Green and guys like Jonathan Simmons and guys like Tony Parker. You know, we saw one of the better Tony Parker games in a while. Patty Mills, even. You know, if you're Tony Allen and you see Patty Mills just feasting the way he was, you've got to be a little discouraged. What type of adjustments do you need to make? Obviously, like you said, Randolph didn't really work at all. And I'm just really kind of looking to see where Memphis goes from here. I mean, I just think this is a bad matchup. I think San Antonio figured it out. We've seen San Antonio sweep Memphis in recent years. You know, again, with Memphis going into the season, I had hoped that Parsons would have given them that new level that they've been lacking. We don't need to keep beating that drum. We know it didn't work. San Antonio, I think, is going to this to me is the least dramatic first round series. I think San Antonio is going to make light work.
Well, they got to get more out of Mike Conley. I mean, 5 of 14, I think, in the second and third quarters of you know, game one, that he had 3 points in both those quarters combined. I was really taken aback. You know, not so much to dig at Memphis because, like to your point, Kevin, this is a really bad matchup. They're obviously outgunned. They're outcoached. Everybody on the Spurs is healthy, which happens very few times. But I was watching it, and between Dwayne Dedmon and Jonathan Simmons, the Spurs are a bit athletic, you know, and obviously you want to throw in Kawhi Leonard there too. But the Spurs are a bit more athletic, I think, than they've been in recent years.
It's just crazy to me. Like, Dwayne Dedmon was on the process Sixers, and the Spurs are now getting top level contributions out of him in the playoffs. And it's just like, dude, Pop is such a genius, man.
Dude, Dwayne Dedmon took 0 shots in 17 minutes.
I'm glad he knows his role, defensive protection. He was and I maintain that, like, I'm not kidding. When he was with us and then he got picked up by Orlando later in that season, he was a good rim protector. It's just he can't do much of anything else.
And that's exactly what the Spurs need because, you know, to our point earlier where we were talking about how do the Grizzlies beat the Spurs, and they're just, you know, make LaMarcus Aldridge play defense. LaMarcus Aldridge, he's not a defensive player. Doesn't like playing defense. They have Pau Gasol. He's not a defensive player. Well, you got Dwayne Dedmon and Jonathan Simmons out there, you know, as well as Kawhi Leonard and Danny Green. And even though Danny Green went 0-2 in that game, he had 4 blocks, 2 steals, 1 steal maybe. But it was really
nice. Excellent all season on defense.
He has. They need to get him going, though. And that was so when I went on that radio show on Friday, I was talking to Anthony with Knock on Sports over at KGEZ, and I was talking to him about what the Spurs are the better team in this series, but Memphis is really good traditionally, and especially this year, they allow the fewest points at the rim in the entire NBA, and so the Spurs were going to need to take this opportunity to get Danny Green going because he's been rather lackluster in the last couple of playoffs, postseason runs for him. And unfortunately, they didn't get him going on the offensive end, but they were able to get him going on the defensive end. That has a lot of value. But I think that they should really spend the series getting Danny Green going on the offensive end, and that'll bode well as they proceed farther into the playoffs.
Yeah, Lord knows they're going to need shooting as they go up against Houston and Golden State. You're going to have to keep up a little bit. Danny Green has been an all NBA level defender this year. I'm curious to see if he gets either first team or second team. I think he's definitely going to be in that conversation. Real quick before we move on to the final game, and you don't have to answer this now because I think there's a long way to go and there's a lot to think about this, but if you're Memphis, at what point are you blowing it up?
See, that's a debate we've had a bunch of times. I don't think, well, for one, they can't really blow it up. They just signed Mike Conley. No one's going to take that contract. So,
yeah, no.
You know, and then they have Chandler Parsons. They don't really have the option to blow it up. But I think if you're a small market team, that you don't always have the option of blowing it up. And they've had a lot of success getting into the playoffs as a smaller market team, which is really hard to do. And I don't necessarily think that just because you aren't the Warriors and just because you don't have LeBron James that you have to say, you know what, we just aren't going to try then. Like, I'm getting really tired of teams saying because we aren't them that we don't need to keep trying. I think with this core that they have, they probably aren't going to win a championship, but they're getting a lot of postseason runs in a smaller market team, and that there is value in being a good team. Well, you know, yes, this year they aren't a high seed, but, you know, they're a good team. Why do they have to blow it up?
Well, I think the theory or the thinking in that is that you've had this core together now for, I mean, the better course of 5, 6, 7 seasons. So it's not like this is something new that you're just going, oh, well, we don't have LeBron James, we're giving up. They've gone to the Western Conference Finals. This core has been successful. It's just the problem with Memphis is if you're a smaller market team, I mean, how do smaller market teams get good and get stars? So many times it's through the draft. And I'm just looking at that war chest if you're Memphis. And, I mean, I completely agree with you with Conley and Parsons. Those are untradeable. You're just stuck with them for better or for worse. I don't think you just sell on a guy like Marc Gasol necessarily either unless you're getting a lot back. But if there are ways to recoup the war chest a little bit and ways to get creative, kind of like Dallas did where they go out and get Nerlens Noel, you know, find ways to get young talent, find situations you can take advantage of, I think you may start to look at that. I'm not saying totally tear it down and go full tank. You know, this core is older. I do think you need to start looking at, you know, beginning to stockpile assets for the future. And that way you can start to build the next great Memphis team. I mean, that core has had a great run. They have an identity. They have an excellent fan base. There's nothing to be ashamed about just because they didn't win a title. You know, they just didn't have the talent, enough talent on those rosters. But they've been a great team to watch for the last few years. I just think you can start to think about blowing it up because it's not like you haven't tried with this team before, you know?
Well, I don't think it's going to be blowing it up. I mean, I do think that you're bringing up good points and that, you know, we've probably seen the best of this core. I don't think it's necessarily going to come from, you know, trading away Marc Gasol and Mike Conley and all that. Like you aren't going to get a lot back for a lot of those pieces. I think that's going to have to come in a resource allocation mode from management. You know, where are they scouting talent from? If it's not going to come in the draft, because they're too good with too many long-term deals to really blow it up. So it's just not going to come in the draft where you get that talent. So you got to put your money into scouting the D-League and scouting overseas. And that is what makes, you know, a good organization and a good general manager isn't just what he says in public or he or she, but where they put that money. And you got to put that money into scouting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in today's NBA, you know, you look at all these guys overseas and where talent is coming from anymore. You know, there's no excuse not to be doing your homework in that aspect. You know, there's more talent in the NBA now than ever. You know, I maintain that somebody we had, you know, at work when I was still in Jacksonville, that he didn't think the NBA was that great right now because there were only two awesome elite teams that you think could win the title. But I just told him I didn't agree with that at all. I think every one of these first round playoff series is compelling. I think almost every single team has at least one guy that's worth watching on a nightly basis. You know, is it the reality that we're probably going to see Golden State and Cleveland again? Yeah, absolutely. I think we all knew that. But let's A, not act like those first two series haven't been awesome, and B, act like there aren't a number of other teams who are on the rise, you know, ready to take those spots. It's just that's where we happen to be right now.
So I was watching the first day of playoffs, and I was so astonished at how good the talent is. Really in all of the games and all of the teams and how every position matters. And I think it was actually in the Grizzly Spurs series where David Fizdale was talking to the team saying, don't look at the score. You have to play every minute of the game. Don't look at the score and just how valued every possession is and how the level of play overall is just completely elevated in the playoffs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think Fizdale is an excellent coach, too. I think Memphis really did a good job at bringing him in. I think he's going to be successful there for a long time. But we do got to talk about we've been getting off topic a little bit here. But I do want to talk about this one final series. You're listening to the Driving Dish NBA podcast. Kevin Rafe, Houston Tompkins, Justin Cousart. Make sure you like our Facebook page at Driving Dish NBA Podcast. One of my favorites, at least when the matchups were released and the seeding was officially finalized, Clippers versus Utah. A little bit of a downturn to that series when Rudy Gobert, quite literally on the first play of the game of Game 1, got hurt. With thankfully nothing is torn, there's no structural damage, but a bone bruise and a sprain, so Rudy Gobert is going to miss time. You know, it's just Utah, man. Poor Utah. Gobert's the one guy who hasn't missed time all season, and they finally are healthy, and then Gobert goes down in the playoffs. But at the same time, it's also a credit to Utah and what they've been doing all season long, that what do they do in Game 1? Go out and get the W behind the Joe Johnson, going ISO Joe and being clutch yet again.
You know who doesn't feel bad for Utah?
Chris Paul?
Clippers fans. I mean, it's incredibly unfortunate. And, you know, to your point, Kevin, you know, thank goodness it's a bone bruise. It is a stretching of the ligaments. He is going to miss time. So he's going to miss time. Other players tend to miss about 3 to 4 weeks. Obviously, we want to see Rudy Gobert in the playoffs. But it's a testament to, I think, their GM and the team as a whole, that they were able to add those veteran pieces this offseason. Players that have played meaningful minutes in the playoffs, not just adding talent that hasn't been there before, but, you know, adding a Boris Diaw and a Joe Johnson. And I don't know about you, but that was the best Joe Johnson game I can remember seeing. I mean, Joe Johnson was so good. There were points in the game. And let me ask you about this one particular play. It was when Blake Griffin was backing down Joe Johnson in the post, and Joe Johnson just moved, got out of the way, and took the chair right out from under him. Blake Griffin fell on the floor.
I did see that.
Did you consider that kind of a cheap defensive play?
No, I don't consider that cheap defensive. Like, if the guy's just going to lean on you and you go to reposition yourself, he shouldn't be leaning on you that much.
Uh-huh.
Keep your center of balance.
I mean, I agree. I've seen it happen a couple of times. It was so veteran savvy. Credit to Chris Paul, though. I have his, and I tweeted it out earlier from our Twitter at Drive and Dish NBA. But Chris Paul, so in the final couple of minutes in regulation there, Chris Paul went on that 10-0 run. He almost single-handedly won the game for him. But looking at, you know, the advanced stats on Chris Paul in that game, Chris Paul, his offensive rating was 137 with a defensive rating of 101. Chris Paul was excellent in that game.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's like we said, Chris Paul just in general has been excellent in the playoffs. Like, let's go back and look at the numbers. Anyone who thinks Chris Paul hasn't been doing the job in the playoffs, you know, blame injuries, blame the teams, whatever you want. But don't blame him. Like you said, excellent down the stretch. Hit the go-ahead bucket with 15 seconds left. So at the end of the day, the last time he had the ball in his hands, he had a successful offensive possession. You know, just credit to Utah for fighting. You know, Blake Griffin, you know, I thought Blake Griffin started going early, but I think credit to the Jazz. I think the Jazz made the adjustments late. You know, Chris Paul certainly did his best. I think this is a series that the Clippers, without Gobert for an extended amount of time, I struggle to see Utah winning this one. I thought Utah was going to win it, but if you're like, losing Gobert just changes the way teams look at you. I mean, you look at those last few plays, and especially even just look at the last possession where Chris Paul scored to take the lead. Does he get into that lane with that much ease with Gobert there? You know, they were running so many high screens and high pick and rolls that I just don't think work when you have a guy like Rudy Gobert in the middle who makes so much of a defensive impact like that for Utah. So if you're Utah, you have to adjust, and they're going to have to figure that out. And they have an advantage, so that goes a long way. You know, you got to hope if you're Utah, you get Gobert back sooner than later. If not, I think the Clippers can get through this one.
Yeah, I was doing my research on this for this podcast right here, and picking the winner in this, because you sounded really confident, Kevin, in that I thought the Jazz, your words saying I thought the Jazz were going to win this one. I looked at the mm-hmm. series, and the best I could come up with was the Clippers winning, because it was going to be a home and home the entire time. And I was trying to break it down and look, you know, the Jazz allow 0.88 points on pick and rolls, the fourth worst in the NBA. Well, the Clippers get 43% of their offense from the pick and roll. So how much will that factor into it? And I came down to it saying to myself, I have no idea really who's going to win this series, but you sounded really confident when you were saying that you thought the Jazz were going to pull this out.
I did. I don't know why. I've been, especially too, because the Clippers were playing better towards the later half of the season. I'd hit a point where I think I was just so uninspired by the Clippers and so just down on this core. And they had, you know, they were going to the playoffs with the same depth issues yet again, which I think is a concern. They were missing Austin Rivers. I mean, we can get the jokes off all we want, but I thought they were missing Austin Rivers. And I think they're going to be missing Austin Rivers, a guy who can go out and get buckets off the bench. You know, again, insert your dad's joke here, but like, it just seems to be the same problems with the Clippers in the playoffs every single year. And I'm not saying that they won't win this series. I think they probably get by it now. But I was confident in the young upstart Utah. I think Utah's depth was going to be too much.
Well, I mean, and that's one of the things when we did our preseason predictions that we talked about the Utah Jazz, right? Was that they were arguably the deepest team in the league.
Mm-hmm. They went out and, well, you mentioned it, pickups like Joe Johnson, Boris Diaw, getting these veterans, guys who have been in the league, who know how to win games, and you know that mattered last night. And the value of a Joe Johnson, he is a guy who, if Joe Johnson can do nothing else at this point of his career, he can score. And when a game breaks down like that, you know, that nickname ISO Joe is for a reason.
Well, and he's
been
playing,
doing this for years.
He's playing really good defense, too, like astonishingly good defense.
Yeah, and credit to Joe Johnson, too, for not trying to just go to a contender in the later stage of his career, you know, for going for a place like Utah where he can make different types of contributions and not just trying to, you know, ring hop on Cleveland and Golden State. You know, no shots at any of the vets who do that. But it's nice to see that. Not every veteran just run into Cleveland trying to get that ring.
I can't argue with that. Yeah, no, I concur. Let me ask you a question, though, before we end this podcast right here. So Luke Mbamute, he played 35 minutes in this game. Paul Pierce played a little over 2 minutes. Is Paul Pierce done? Because it's not so much that Paul Pierce only played 2.5 minutes. It's that Paul Pierce played 2.5 minutes while Luke Mbamute played 35. I mean, that's a level of competition in my mind for Paul Pierce is Luke, and is he done?
Luke's a good defensive player. I think that's selling Luke a little short. Like, Luke is an excellent defender. Not, again, you can sag off him. He can hit three-pointers, but you don't really have to worry about as much on the offensive end. But, you know, what is Paul Pierce is not really giving you much at this point of his career. I think he's just there for a mentorship.
2.5 minutes, though? I mean, I guess we're both agreeing he's done. I guess I just thought that they were saving Paul Pierce for the playoffs, and we were going to get a good 10, 12 minutes out of him.
I think you will at some point. Like, I'm sure they're going to have to. There will be one of those games where they'll break him out of ice for 10 or 12 minutes. But, yeah, I don't think Paul Pierce has much in the tank at this point. I think 2 years ago was probably the last great Paul Pierce moments that we saw when he was with Washington.
Most fates, his offensive rating was 146 compared to his defensive rating of 101. He was excellent. I mean, to your point, though, earlier, is that the Clippers have to get more contributions off their bench. I do agree with you that they were really missing Austin Rivers. Jamal Crawford, though, offensive rating of 59, defensive rating of 108. That's a huge disparity right there. He went 4 for 12 from the field, 0 for 4 from 3-point, 8 points and 12 shots. He's not exactly a elite defender. So if he's not giving you offense, like the Clippers need, you know, because that's going into the series, the Clippers had the second best starting five in the NBA, right behind the Warriors. And the only question really was the bench. And it's crazy that this series, to a certain extent, you know, regardless of what happens with Gobert, might actually come down to Austin Rivers.
What a world we live in, huh? Came down to Austin Rivers.
The Miami Heat missing the playoffs thanks to no Dion Waiters.
Oh, dude, the Miami Heat, I wanted the Heat to make it so bad. And they did everything right, too. They won all the way up. It was just, there was a loss against the Knicks they had 2 weeks before the season ended. And there was just, unfortunately, there was no room for error. And it stunk. You even knew it a little bit that Miami was going to miss. And the problem was, the thing is, Chicago playing a little better at the end made it easier to swallow for me. If Chicago had just stumbled into it, but I think the fact that they played better over those last 2 weeks helped. But yeah, that was disappointing. I almost even wanted to get rid of Atlanta to put Miami in. Like, no offense to the Hawks. I like Millsap. I like Budenholzer. I just have no interest in watching Atlanta lose in the playoffs again. Well, thank you everyone for listening to this episode of the Driving Dish NBA podcast. We appreciate you guys as always. Shout out to good folks at Blog Talk Radio for hosting the show. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at Drive and Dish NBA, on Instagram at Drive and Dish Podcast, like our Facebook page at Drive and Dish NBA Podcast.
And seriously, your support does mean the world to us. If you want to go over to driveanddishpodcast.com and click on the link at the very top, we have a video up there, and help us get to the NBA Summer League. We'll make sure to give you a shout out on the show, and it really does mean a lot from all three of us.
I think we've done enough dancing for today, so why don't we dance Wednesday?
See you, Starside.
Okay, well, I'm out of here.
Pigeon in the hole.
Da 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 da. Hey. Da 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 da. Hey.
Let's go while we're young.
All right. I think they get the point.